And then when I got to post, then I literally had to sit there night after night, weekend after weekend, writing like 7,000 comments. I was like, fuck, like this better be worth it, you know?
Welcome to Sincast, presented by CinemaSins.
Everybody, welcome to the SinCast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by Barrett Sher from CinemaSins.
Hello!
Today we have a very special guest. It's director Eugene Kotliarenko, who has done a movie called Spree, coming out on August 14th, which we're doing this interview on the 12th, so it's 2 days for us. And it stars Joe Keery from Stranger Things. And it's tapping into the zeitgeist, right?
I mean, I hope so. I mean, I think I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's an extremely contemporary film. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say that I think teenagers and, you know, younger people will really connect with it. Or at least those are, my goals.
Yeah. I was sitting there trying to think of how I would describe this movie. And I was thinking this is like a movie about a mass killing, but instead of a gun being used, it's sort of the crave for fame that is killing everybody in this movie. And talk a little bit about where you got your idea for this movie.
Yeah, so it started with my co-writer, Gene McHugh. He came to me and he said, you know, like, I think we could make a really powerful sort of like minimal horror film with the idea of a kind of rideshare Uber driver going around and killing his passengers. And, you know, the share economy, gig economy, whatever, like we just trust people to get into their cars because they have a 5-star rating. There is an inherent, like, you know, horror and terror built into that. And so I thought, yeah, this could be good, but like really, why does he do it? Is he driven by a certain ideology? And so it took us a second, you know, spitballing ideas to kind of realize, well, what if he's just doing it, you know, for the clout, for attention, for the likes? And that, you know, when we realized that he was maybe thirsty for social media virality, became like, you know, you have to synthesize these two ideas, right? The inherent terror of getting into a car with someone that you don't know and something that we've normalized and now take for granted. And the sort of like addiction that we all have, where the little monster lives inside of all of us and says, hey, when you wake up in the morning, don't you want to see if anyone gave you any virtual love? Don't you want to see if you matter? And as you go out through your day, every single experience you have, you question, oh, should I post this? Should I mediate my experience for attention right now so that I can feel good about myself? So those two ideas kind of were the origin of the film. And, you know, it's in the tradition, I hope, of like, you know, kind of social, of media satires. So movies like Network or Ace in the Hole, To Die For, you know, A Face in the Crowd, right? Like A Face in the Crowd and To Die For explicitly are movies where, and also King of Comedy are movies where, you know, people use media and exploit sensationalism, you know, violence and prurience and all these things for attention, because they know that's what gets attention in the sort of media landscape. And so, you know, Spree is very much in the tradition of those sort of media critique films.
I'm glad that you said to Die For, because I was sitting there. That was the movie that kept coming up in my head during this, because, you know, Nicole Kidman's Suzanne Stone character in that movie is always talking about how you're just not anybody unless you're famous. And she is trying everything that she can to get to that. She thinks this, you know, like this small little thing is going to get her boosted in the into the stratosphere, but it doesn't. But the other ones that I was thinking of is there's an episode with Bryce Dallas Howard of Black Mirror that has the whole rating system.
Yeah.
Thing that, you know, people's worth are based on that rating. And then, and I don't mean to say this because you know, your movie is derivative of this. your movie is completely original.
We're all making observations, you know, about the world we live in, right? So I like Black Mirror very much. I actually thought that the Choose Your Own Adventure Bandersnatch thing was probably my favorite movie of 2019 or 18 or whatever it came out.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's that in that show is speculative fiction, right? It's kind of sci-fi, and we're living in that nightmare now. And that's kind of what Spree is about. You know, one thing that, you know, is horrifying that we take for granted is this operating principle that sharing is inherently good. You know, and that's what kind of aligns Kurt's character with the Nicole Kidman character in To Die For, that she believes that no matter what she does, it's towards an end game, which is good, which is, you know, getting her on air and getting her voice out there and whatever kind of clout that accrues her. And Kurt, you know, he is engaging in a tutorial, which is like inherently good, regardless of the fact that the tutorial is about how to kill people for attention.
Right.
You know, he's not thinking about that. It's all about end game. It's all about numbers and sort of, you know, virality. And, you know, that's a sickness that we all kind of lives inside of us to some extent. That once we participate in this social media kind of attention economy, we are all now imbued with that desire to get the dopamine hits and get the attention. And, you know, oftentimes don't really consider what immoral things or what kind of, you know, shameless things we're doing for that attention.
What's odd, I guess it's not odd, but what's interesting about watching your movie is, aside from the fact that this person is doing horrendous things to get likes and attention and everything, it's exactly how a normal channel would get likes and attention and everything through their content. It doesn't matter how interesting your content is. It doesn't matter if it's the best thing that you've ever done or whatever, you end up needing influencers to get to a certain
larger audience.
Yeah, exactly. The YouTube a long time ago, I believe there was even a TED talk on this, of course. One of the things that that guy at that TED talk said was, here's the video of Double Rainbow Guy. And it's, you know, a video that's hundreds of millions of views. So a lot of people would look at that and go, wow, how did this ever get that way? And he showed a chart and it showed that nobody watched it at all for 2 years until Jimmy Kimmel found it. And Jimmy Kimmel brings it up on his show. And then suddenly that's where you get your viral hit. It's the truth about everything. And unfortunately, you see a lot of these people, you see a lot of people who are famous on YouTube and everything, and you wonder, how did they get that way? And it's usually some sort of combination of that, but it makes other regular people go, well, if they can do that, I can do that. Where's my likes and attention?
Well, yeah. So look, the promise of the early internet, and, you know, on some level, is like to democratize everyone's sort of participation and communication, right? So like the 20th century, you know, you had your corporate hegemony over like all of media, right? And so what the internet and social media promised was that everyone would have a voice now, and it would be on an equal playing field, and everyone is just as, you know, possible to get the likes. And that's obviously not the case, right? The reason we call people influencers is because they have a gatekeeping capacity, right? They have a built-in audience now, and they get to decide what is and isn't like important. The other sort of thing that goes along with that is like, you know, the narrative of, you know, sharing is that you are at the center of your own universe. Like, you know, you are the main character in your own narrative. And while that is ostensibly true, if you have no moons or planets revolving around your sun, space can be a lonely place, you know? Yeah. Start seeing other universes and other people's narratives that are extremely popular, you start feeling really inadequate and shitty. and bad about yourself and look for ways to start feeling, you know, relevant, or like Kurt says in the movie, if you don't document yourself, you don't exist.
Yeah.
You know? And that's the proposition and sort of framework that we're all operating under, that, you know, the movie is sort of asking the viewer to like kind of question as it's entertaining them. Right. Like, I mean, there's really heavy issues in the movie, but at the end of the day, I think the movie is like just fun to watch and like kind of like wild and stuff.
Yeah. Sure. What's emblematic about that is the comments in the Periscope feed or the live feed, mm-hmm. or whatever it is, of encouraging this sort of behavior, asking to go, you know, further with it and, you know, liking it. And there's occasionally a comment like, are you serious?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, that's dangerous or something like that. But by and large, they're like, keep it going, you know, and it's feeding the beast, as I think you may have said, to make him at one point. There's a question of whether he'll go even further to keep this going and actually make it bigger and make it more palatable for this wider audience.
I mean, Kurt is constantly making calculations about like what will help him go viral. Even in the first scene, you know, I don't want to give it away, but like the behavior of the first passenger, he's like, well, I will never go viral if I allow you to like say and do these horrible things.
Right.
You know, and he doesn't have any moral quandary against, like, you know, I'll just say right now, like this white supremacist guy in his car, he has no moral issues with it. It's just that he knows that stuff is toxic. That stuff gets people canceled. I mean, we wrote this like 5 years ago, but I think it still obviously as relevant today.
Yeah.
But also the comments, right? So the movie is presented as a live stream, right? And it's Kurt presenting this live stream tutorial about how to go viral. And for me, in the earliest days of the script and pre-production, I knew that, you know, the comments would be so important. And then when I got to post, and I literally had to sit there night after night, weekend after weekend, writing like 7,000 comments, I was like, fuck, like this better be worth it, you know? And I think it is. I mean, you know, viewers can decide, but if you pause the movie at any given point and you just look at like the 7 comments that are up on screen at that moment, they will all make sense of what's going on in the movie. They will provide humor. They will provide cringe factor. And they will provide like kind of like almost like the voice of the viewing audience of the movie, but also a really corrupt and immoral version of that, because that's what happens online. You know, you just want to egg on sensational behavior because that's what we get off on as voyeurs, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man, those comments are a second movie unto themselves, aren't they? you know, it's hard to know exactly, and this is what's going to give this movie such great repeat viewing value, is that, you know, it's hard to know whether to look at the action on screen or just look at what the comments are. And the comments are as horrifying, probably. I mean, maybe nobody's killing anybody with those comments, but they kind of are in some other, you know, extended way. But there is a horrifying nature to those in on multiple levels. First off, nobody believes this is real at all. I understand why they wouldn't. Why would anybody do this? There's no, you know, there doesn't seem to be any sense to that whole thing. But none of this seems real. And I tell you what a brilliant stroke of this movie is having a character like Bobby Basecamp in here, who is a known prank YouTuber, which makes everything just compile on that whole thing. I'm not sure if I'm asking you a question, but
I'm glad you picked up on that. And that was like another specific niche of a kind of influencer YouTube culture I wanted to, you know, make fun of, a sort of like exploitative prankster who is peddling in like sort of very immoral behavior, but then just says, it's just a prank, you know?
Right.
Because that is basically almost like epigrammatic of, you know, the immorality of sensationalism, a clickbait, you know, that is basically walking clickbait, these pranks that go too far because they're just about getting attention and, you know, not really entertainment as we understand it.
Yeah.
You nailed the tone. I've been very familiar with not only the big ones, the Paul brothers and all that, but you know, the lesser widely known YouTubers that traffic in this. Not only do you get the content right, but the wide-eyed enthusiasm that Joe Keery brings to this character, mm-hmm. which I assume you must have worked with him to develop this, is spot on to these people. I watch these guys and women and girls, and I'm wondering, like, where do you get this energy to just constantly be loud and up there and out there and all that stuff? And, you know, everything is sick, bro, and blah, and bullshit, and yeah, and all that stuff. And he nails this, as does Bobby Basecamp's character, too. And so that character in particular rang as artificial as the character is, it rang perfectly true to what you see on the actual YouTube. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we're constantly being forced to perform and present, you know, like a kind of high energy image because we know that garners attention on at least a popular level. And so, yeah, I mean, Kurt is this bouncy, cheery monster, right, who sort of naively believes he's helping people. And that is a lot of where the horror comes from. And, you know, Bobby character is a bit more of like a bully and stuff. And, you know, he also has to be like a high energy bully. but, you know, but one of the things that fascinated me about that is, you know, Bobby has that homeless hero video and, you know, not to spoil it, but like, it's totally fake. And that has happened a few times. There have been people who have orchestrated these like, you know, stunts with, homeless people where it looks like, oh, they're helping them, but it's actually all been entirely orchestrated. And, you know, that sort of scam on the sort of belief, you know, that we place and the trust that we place into visual representation and into like our kind of informal media culture that we have now is, you know, another way that people become famous. That's, you know, probably not as horrific as violence and murder, but, you know, also morally bankrupt. Right, to sort of prey upon people's sympathy and prey upon people's sort of charity, you know. And Josh, who played Bobby, the actor Josh Ovi, he was extremely popular on Vine, and that's sort of how I got you know, smart to him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's super super funny Vine creator who then became kind of YouTube make creator too, and you know, he completely understood those types of super like hype beasty, immoral kind of fuck boys that he was able to make fun of really well.
I love those little clips too of him they're building his character and everything, and he's talking about, you know, he's like,
I'm in my home theater thanks to you guys. And he's talking about, well, he also talks about the pool incident, which was like explicit reference to like this thing with Dan Bilzerian, who's one of like the worst types of like kind of clout chaser influencer types, where you know, a pool incident where a girl got hurt and he's like kind of passing the buck and passing the blame to someone else. We had a lot of fun doing that with Josh and with Joe. I mean, Joe dove extremely deeply into his character prep, and we watched tons and tons of videos of, you know, basically single digit YouTube accounts of people who, you know, desperately were trying to become influencers. And I mean, the irony of the Kurt character, which we pulled from a lot of these people, is imagine someone who has no following, no views, offering you a tutorial on how to grow your following or how to go viral. I mean, the irony is completely lost on the people making it. And it's extremely sad. And it's also extremely disturbing, especially if a person like that decided to engage in, you know, murder.
Yeah. I mean, what's ironic to me is you guys exploring these single digit subscriber view accounts, and they're seeing, you know, their fifth view, and it's you guys who are making a movie about them, you know? It's like, oh, hey, I got a new view. Oh, yeah, they're researching about the whole.
Well, I'll just leave anonymous who we looked at. But I will say, you know, for every Logan Paul or successful influencer you've heard of, there's 100,000 people trying to do literally the exact same thing with the exact same script, with the exact same sort of like, you know, signify, like you were saying, you know, like, oh, they have to be high energy, or they have to say bro, or they have to kind of wrap up a video in a certain way. They're all operating from like this script, and they just don't have the like it factor, or je ne sais quoi, or the originality to really become a successful singer. But that doesn't stop them from trying. That doesn't stop them from posting every day. And, you know, that impulse is really an indicator of where our society is and where what we've all bought into, you know. And I think it's worth making fun of, and it's worth pointing out, and it's worth, you know, kind of reexamining in a narrative way.
It's pretty obvious that Joe Keery got into this character because, it, you know, and there's a lot of other like physical things that he does in this, and his hair, and even is even a character in this. The just, you know, if you're used to seeing a guy, and I've seen Joe Keery in only a couple of things. I saw him in Stranger Things. I saw him in Molly's Game. The just seeing sort of a transformation and just complete different. A completely different person. This is kind of, you know, this is an incredible performance that he's putting on here. And, you know, it might be a, you know, sort of a telling of what kind of future he may have, I think, to really break out, I think. I mean, he's broken out enough with Stranger Things, obviously, but I think as you know, someone to get tapped to do a lot of other more interesting projects down the line.
Yeah, let me just say, because like I'm biased, obviously, but like Joe is like a top level actor. Like, I mean, the his ability to, you know, extract pathos and really subtle things that connect with viewers from moments of, you know, cringy comedy or from moments of kind of like monstrous behavior is really special. And he was constantly creating things on set. You know, a lot of the actors in a way are left to their own devices in the car, because I'm in a follow car and with a walkie talkie and some, you know, sort of monitors and stuff, but we let them go for multiple takes, you know, and I would just give them notes in between takes. But it's not like a normal movie. We were doing coverage between mediums and close-ups and master shots and da-da-da. And so you constantly are reassessing performance, you know, for the little increment of a scene. These were entire scenes that, you know, were allowed to kind of flow naturally, and the creation that Joe brought to each and every take was so inspiring and impressive. And you know, I have full confidence that Joe will, you know, like have a very strong career. And you know, to me, to anyway, people will see the movie and they'll just feel the performance. But like, you know, on Stranger Things, which is a really good show and obviously is full of a bunch of really good performers, that's an ensemble cast. So you can't really, they all are good, but you can't really understand the depths of their skill level. Right. And here Joe carries the movie from beginning to end.
Sure. There's nowhere to hide, right? I mean, he's essentially the movie. It's almost like Locke, the Tom Hardy movie that came out a few years ago, that where it's by and large only set in that car and from that vantage point where you've got all these cameras set up. So there's a lot of pressure on there.
Don't want to be a hater, but I don't like that movie.
Oh, really?
Well, you know, I wanted to watch certain things that, you know, felt like, oh, working in the mode of like, you know, the restraint of what we were trying to do in the movie, like, you know, minimally you're in the car for, let's say, 70% of this film. And I just couldn't get into that one. Like, it just not only did it feel like trapped, I it just felt boring kind of to me.
Okay.
But there is a movie that I can, you know, shout out, which is way more like, let's say, obscure than that film, but I found to be way more engaging, which is it's called Taxi Tehran by Jafar Pernahi. You know, and he's an Iranian filmmaker who was basically banned from making movies in his country because he's like too political. And so he's made one film in his apartment called This Is Not a Movie. And then he made this other film called Taxi Tehran, where basically he put cameras in his car and uses it as sort of like a, you know, informal cab around the city. And it's just constantly innovative, the way it's asking you questions about whether it's real or staged, about, like, you know, who's controlling the camera, and about, like, certain meta qualities, whether he's acting or not. And just constantly keeps you on your toes as a viewer visually, without the inherent sort of genre trappings of a movie like Locke, which is ostensibly like a thriller. You know?
I got to check that out.
Yeah, you guys should watch it. That's a movie that I had a list, you know, of movies that I shared with the cast and crew. And that was one of them, along with, you know, some of the movies we mentioned before, but also a movie like Man Bites Dog. Do you know that one?
Yeah.
A mockumentary about a serial killer, or, you know, Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, which, you know, has all of these weird, all these weird registers of comedy in something that, you know, is horrifying, but does not play like a normal horror film, you know, and that's kind of what we wanted to do too.
And at first, because the first victim is so starkly political, or whatever you want to call it, I thought this was going along the track of a modern retelling of The Last Supper, which, you know, I don't know if you know that movie at all, but
no, I don't.
The Last Supper is about a bunch of self-proclaimed liberals who don't feel like they don't feel like they are making any changes in the world. And they believe that conservatives, when they get in office, they actually take action. They do what they say that they're going to do. And they get an unexpected guest who has a lot of right wing views, and they accidentally kill that person. It's Bill Paxton. So they kill Bill Paxton. And then after they, you know, decided to cover it up, they all agree that they're going to invite other right wing people that they've seen on TV and in the newspapers and everything over to dinner and give them poisoned wine when they're unable to change their views and everything. So when that first victim came up, I was like, oh, okay, we might have a little modern retelling here, but it doesn't.
Yeah, but I do think one thing about, you know, the first act of the film with the writers and stuff is that, you know, Kurt is doing these horrific things, but at the same time, the people that he's sort of like dispatching, you don't really mind seeing them, you know, disappear off the face of the earth. And so, you know, that kind of complicates the moral position of an audience member towards Kurt. You know, because there's, I don't want to say a sense of like heroism to him, but he seems a little bit more palatable than the people he's getting rid of. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then things get twisted a little more once Jesse enters the picture, and then a little bit more once you find out certain things that, you know, maybe he's not going viral, even though he presents as he is going viral. So that was definitely intentional, to kind of add some sort of like, you know, political and social commentary to those first people, because, you know, you have your white supremacist, you have your kind of like real estate flipper who's like gentrifying neighborhoods,
right?
And you have your sort of like misogynistic pickup artist guy who's just like a pussy hound or whatever. So
it's a nice entry into that where you almost feel for him, and it helps you connect with the character while he gets more and more grotesque.
And I think like that's correct in a way. Obviously, like when people watch, Kurt is a loser at the end of the day, and I don't think any of the things he's doing are fucking cool or sexy, or like, you know, most movies that have like these serial killer characters or like are hyper violent aestheticize it, you know. And perfectly good satirical movies like Natural Born Killers or Clockwork Orange, you know, the latter being a movie that I really revere, also really aestheticize these acts of violence. And I just wanted our film to be different, you know, to really approach what he's doing in like a sort of brutal and uncool way, where, you know, we're really skewering and making fun of someone who would use like violence as a shortcut while still presenting it in a kind of unique cinematic language that would be kind of, you know, interesting to watch, but not interesting to like want to become. You know, which is, I think, one of the dangers of these types of movies. I think actually Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer does a really good job of that too, in that there's something very disturbing about what he's doing, and you don't really access, like, you don't revel in it, you know, in a way that you might a movie like American Psycho or, you know, Natural Born Killers, which are both so tongue-in-cheek in their satire, you know? Mm.
Yeah, I was going to ask you this question because it's kind of hard to make this kind of a movie, right? Because you don't want to glorify what he's doing, and I don't personally think you do at all.
Yeah.
The problem is with some of the with these movies, a lot of times are other people, and you can't really change what other people think of. Like, you know, a movie like Fight Club obviously is not espousing fight clubs. Like, it's not telling you to go out and start one or do anything like that. But yet, that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, but Brad Pitt is like super like cool and hot and like someone that like you want to become. I mean, that's right. Part of the critique of the movie, that he's also like a, you know, spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't seen Fight Club, like schizophrenic projection of like a beta loser Ed Norton.
Right.
But it's what you're saying. It is exactly. It's very tricky. Like, for instance, like, you know, someone attempted to assassinate President Reagan because they fell in love with Jodie Foster and wanted to become Travis Bickle in Taxi right. Driver. And while that movie is clearly a critique, it's also highly empathic. And it's also like, you know, feels scary, but also badass when he shows up with the Mohawk and does all this shit. But no one out there is trying to be Rupert Pupkin, who is like, you know, the character from King of Comedy, where it's painful to watch him.
Yeah.
And that's kind of more was like the guiding force for me and Joe with Kurt, or definitely for me. I know Joe was looking more to the real influencers or the real wannabe influencers as kind of finding the sort of scariness and also the sadness of them. But for me, it's kind of like, you don't want to make, you know, I love Wolf of Wall Street. That's a movie that, you know, 10% of the total population that sees that movie is a hardcore critique of like, you know, capitalistic excess and like, criminality of Wall Street. And then the other 90% just views it as pure revelry in, you know, hyper like, you know, consumer or hyper capitalism or something. And, you know, it's really tricky making satires. And I try to approach it with a real sensitivity, you know.
I'm glad that you brought that up, because that's something that I don't think I've ever really thought about before. The portrayal of the character themselves being cool versus, you know, bringing up Taxi Driver versus King of Comedy is a great comparison there, because you're absolutely right. Nobody wants to be Rupert Pupkin at all. One question I would have, do people want to be Joker then, if that's it?
Well,
you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, when Joker came out, I was like, whatever, but I do think that there's a really serious distinction between Spree and Joker, which is that, like what you're saying, like the whole first part of Joker, you're just watching this character constantly being shit on, mm-hmm. you know, and like, being unable to like articulate a response to the brutalization that's happening to him. And then all of a sudden he kills someone and he goes from being a beta to an alpha, and mm-hmm. he starts dancing around and singing and like being happy. And like, that's a, you know, even though that movie I think is like, you know, critical in some ways, it's pretty irresponsible to present that model to people of like, hey, or do you feel shit on? Well, go out there and fucking kill a bunch of people and start a revolution.
Yeah.
Maybe you'll start dancing, kid. You know, it's like,
you are preaching to the choir, by the way.
I don't really have that serious of an issue with the movie, because ultimately I think, you know, people will find their own ways to engage in immorality for love. And it's more of a critique of a system than of a type of person, in my opinion. But yeah, I do think Spree is much more, you know, whatever, on the right side of history, to use like a kind of lame expression, than Joker. But hopefully it's as fun or more fun than that movie too.
Yes, know? It is. It is much more fun than Joker. I can tell you 100% it is much more fun than Joker.
Okay, awesome. I mean, I'm obviously biased. But,
yeah, we are not, and we believe this movie is better than Joker. One of the aspects when we first got a press release about Spree, I went and researched the movie and everything. This was probably about a month or so ago, and I saw a passing interview with Joe Carey where he mentioned the mental health aspect of this movie. What are the sort of statements or research or what went into this movie?
Well, no, I think the research is like I was saying before, we watched so many videos and posts from, you know, people who kind of were oblivious to their own transparent, naked thirst for attention. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Joe put himself through the ringer of making a lot of those videos, you know, finding Kurt through making tutorials and reviews and unboxing and all that stuff. And that kind of ended up partly, even though those were exercises to get to character, they actually ended up in the film and the opening montage and throughout. And actually,
really? Those were him like trying to find the character, like the vaping and the mouthfeel?
The vaping and the mouthfeel was like an onset thing that we shot. But for instance, the Draw My Life sort of biography thing, yeah, that was a way for Joe and I to figure out the background, the backstory of Kurt. And then, of course, it became the sort of backbone for the opening montage of the film.
Nice.
And then we've been actually promoting the film the last month on Instagram through this account. It's a kind of meta, almost Blair Witch-like promotional campaign where it's his IG is at Kurt's World 96. And we've been using so many of Joe's reviews and exercises to, you know, grab an audience. And we have over 50,000 followers right now. And they're very, very fervent, engaged fan base that believes it's all happening, you know, kind of in real time, even though Joe and I made this material over the course of, you know, many months in 2019 and early 2020.
Wow.
That's another thing about that opening montage thing is, because you don't know he's unpopular or nobody watches him or anything. You don't know that at first. It doesn't look any different from any other popular video blog and everything. It looks like he is somebody who does a popular one. I mean, that marker board thing, I was like sitting there going, wow, yeah, that's probably something that people watch all the time, right? But, you know, there's a billion marker board things that are out
Exactly.
You know, but
there is literally, you know, hundreds of thousands of Draw My Life, you know, meme videos where people talk about their life and has, you know, 10 views. And something that really was interesting to me in those videos is how they conflate kind of really mundane events with like tragic events. So they'll talk about how, you know, they got a paper cut, and then they'll talk about 9/11 as like the same sort of effect on them. Hmm. Or they'll talk about, you know, how like they won, in some gaming experience they had, and in the next breath they talk about how their father's dead or something. Right. So it's weird, this weird baselining. It goes back to that earlier thing of how sharing somehow is inherently good. We kind of stop evaluating the actual, you know, thematic value of the content and just view it all as baseline content. And that creates a really dangerous like kind of value system. And that's also kind of why we decided to shoot with these sort of detached cameras. I mean, it sounds kind of like a leap and stuff, but, you know, he's setting up these cameras and they're static as the car is moving. And he's, you know, you have your phone and it's like this kind of like, there's no lens on it. There's no rack focus on it, right? Mm-hmm. And there's this sort of like flatness to the brutal presentation of the film, which still is like edited and paced, I think, in a way that's like, you know, very watchable, but this sort of detached and brutal quality, I think, is a reflection of like, you know, social media and how it sort of like flattens all of our experiences into like, okay, how do the numbers feel about this, regardless of like what the subject is, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All this time, and we haven't even mentioned Sasheer Zamata yet.
She's awesome.
Yeah.
God, yeah. I've only seen her fleetingly on Saturday Night Live, so it was very interesting to see her in a full-fledged role in this movie. I think I'd seen her maybe in a couple other movies. But
she played a lead in a movie I saw called The Weeknd, which was kind of like a rom-com that's not too dissimilar from like, or let's say a relationship comedy, not too dissimilar from the sort of films I had made before. Mm-hmm. And when she was on screen, it was like magnetic, and you could really feel her carrying and improvising in this way that, I just immediately sensed. So mm-hmm. I was like, she's really going to be able to kind of like, care. It's a heavy load because, you know, she's not the character that carries the movie, but she is ostensibly the hero. So she gets way less screen time, but she's the one that you relate to the most, just on a normal level. You know, obviously Joe, you relate to him because he's, you're looking at him all the time and you feel his sadness and you're laughing at him, but she's the hero, you know?
Yeah, this is a really great building of a character, because when she's first introduced, you know, you have the smarmy guy in the backseat of the car who's like, I think I kind of know who you are. And then, okay, she's an up and coming stand up comic. And she's got the wonderfully titled for this movie, All Eyes on Me.
Catchphrase.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, at first you're like, okay, well, she's a stand-up comic, blah, blah, blah. She's the one that gets away. There's not really much left to do with her character once she gets out of the spree ride. But it's just fun seeing how much of a change she goes through all in this one day. And then it's so many different changes, how many ups and downs her character has to go through to finally arrive at where she is by the end of the movie. I just wanted to talk about her because I thought she was awesome.
Yeah. Well, like the intro to her, right, is like, you've gone through these kind of like basically 2.5 shitty passenger rides and you know what Kurt's up to by this point. And so then when you first see her, and then she's like, no, thanks, I don't want to get in. I really want the audience to be like, phew, okay, she seems normal. Like, we don't want her to die. And then he follows her. And, you know, the pickup artist guy's like egging him on, like, go pick her up. Like, don't be a pussy or whatever. And so you're like, Eric, don't get in this car. You know, you want the audience to be like, don't get in this car. Yeah. And then he's like, well, I could take you for free. And she's like, okay. And you're like, no. And so then you're kind of like, okay, like maybe this could be like the final girl or something like that. You know, you kind of plant that idea in people's minds. Also, for the entirety of the film up until that point, you're basically claustrophobically stuck in Kurt's world, literally in his camera feed and stuff. And she at some point, you know, puts the pickup artist guy on blast, and you finally are able to take a breather and cut out of the dash cams into her phone, where she's like, you know, like basically like grilling that guy. So you know, on a formal level and on a storytelling level, she introduces, you know, kind of like a breath of fresh air into the film. And then, of course, when she kind of survives that ride, spoiler alert, we hope that she'll come back, you know?
Yeah.
But working with her was really easy. Like, the first day of the shoot was actually her stand-up routine.
Right.
Because we had to, Kyle Mooney had like a really complicated schedule, and so we had to do his scenes first. And so, I mean, that's really hard. It's 10 pages of stand-up material. And she was able to, because she has such a, you know, she is a stand-up herself, nail it from beginning to end every take. And I said to her, like, you know, it'd be easy to break this up into chunks and I have the coverage and stuff. And she's like, no, let me just do it straight through. And I think that was really helpful to Joe. Cause you know, he was like, he's so active in this movie. That is probably his most passive scene. And so he had to really kind of go through the journey of like being an observer and then finally feeling the transformation just in his face. Like, wow, someone finally notices me. I mean, like, you know, that's what happens in that scene, right?
Yeah.
So Sashir's great. She's super talented.
I'm assuming that all the numerous clips of we see of her, you know, in all the different stages and everything, those are her actual stand-up.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a montage we made from her like, past stand-up, you know, career. And I think it works really well, you know, sort of like, I mean, we're lucky, like, you know, imagine if we hadn't cast, I mean, this wasn't really a conversation, but if we hadn't cast a comedian, we wouldn't have, like the way we have Kurt's intro through his social media, like Joe and I had to make that, it would have been like 10 million, but those are all like in a bedroom or in a random room. It would have been 10 million times harder to like cast an actress who didn't have a stand-up background and then like what, try to fake stand, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, exactly. When you think about that scene, that sequence, and I'm so glad it was shot uninterrupted. That's the heart of the movie almost, because you get her perspective almost validating Kurt's perspective in a warped way, right? Where she's saying, you know, this used to be me, that kind of thing. And she's been thinking about this for a while. And then, you know, that contrasted with Kyle Mooney just bombing the fuck out of the stage right before her, which is equally hilarious. It's just it slows everything down to like a heartbeat, and then you know we're off and running to you know to the finale. But like I really really dug that scene and that sequence, how it played off of. You know, you don't even know at this point that Joe is there or that Kurt is there. And so you're just mesmerized by what is on screen. And you're right. She's the perfect person to carry and to keep your eye on that stage the whole time. It's fantastic.
I mean, to me, that scene, too, just to talk about it for one more second. When I was writing it, that was one of the most exciting scenes to me, not just because of like, you know, her performance and the content of what she's saying, but on a formal level, visual level, it's like I knew because she has the catchphrase, "All eyes on me." Part of her shtick is that everyone takes out their phones and is filming it. Right. So it's presented multiple phones in an audience. And up until that point in the film, you've basically had a very monolithic view of a perspective, right, which is Kurt's perspective. But now all of a sudden you're jumping between all these other viewpoints and Kurt, who obviously has a really evil mission in that scene. And so I wanted to create like a sense of identity, a sense of anxiety, like, will he or won't he? You know, I thought about like the scene in The Man Who Knew Too Much, where the audience knows that something horrible will happen at this concert when the music hits a certain point, but no one in the crowd at the concert does. Yeah. And similarly here, we as a viewing audience of the film know what Kurt's horrible, horrific intentions are, and we keep jumping in and out of his POV, almost like a first-person shooter POV, to these other POVs that have no idea about, like, you know, the monster that is among them. You know, and so just visually, I really like that scene, and hopefully it does. I mean, so far, I feel people have talked to me about it, so I hope it creates tension for viewers. You know,
well, yeah, especially you know, considering what Dave Chappelle just came out with on Netflix. That's what sort of that reminded me of was, you know, she went up there and decided that she was just going to be decidedly unfunny, but like maybe not unfunny, but just. You just grab your attention. Yeah. Just grab your attention with something. And, you know, like the stand up doesn't necessarily need to make you laugh for you to be enthralled with it. It's funny though. The Kyle Mooney bombing part. I've got to ask like how that process was. Did he write that material? You guys must've been like, almost laughing at how unfunny it was.
No, we definitely were. And that was a big decision in the edit. I was like, look, we have to remove all laughter from this so that it's explicit to at home audience that the film presents this as bombing, even if you are laughing at it on your own. So, I mean, yeah, that duality of it is an intention. But Kyle is super funny. I mean, look, Kyle's character, right, is basically like Kurt Kunkel without the violence, right?
Yeah.
It's like really pathetic dope, like looking for attention and validation and like being really naked about how desperate he is. Kyle, yeah, I think came up with all of that material. And, you know, he has like a character on SNL that's kind of like a bad stand-up. Mm-hmm. And I just said to him, like, let's, you know, very explicitly like avoid that energy. And let's turn it into like a, you know, like who is this person, right? He's a guy in LA who MCs a open mic or comedy night or whatever. And maybe he's seen a bunch of comics make it and, you know, in the world, but he himself never will. And like, what kind of material does that guy do where he's like constantly like, you know, maybe cribbing from other people's acts. So it should feel kind of stale, like the joke about porn.
Right.
Like
that's what I was about to say. Yeah. It's like, it's just like porn. That's weird. Right. You know? And you're like, oh God. Yeah. It is weird, man. You're right.
When we talk about Sosheer Dezamata is being the hero of the story, and you mentioned Kurt is a loser. Almost every male character in this movie is a loser, including his dad, David Arquette's character, who goes from, you know, the intro of, you know, the drawing board type of description to where you don't even realize how much of a loser this poor guy is. And I say poor in air quotes, really. Mm-hmm. You know, his relationship with Kurt is not something that you see every day, specifically on film. It's complicated. It's not necessarily completely antagonistic, but it's also not completely, it's certainly not healthy.
No, yeah.
And there's just so many layers to this. And I think both of them play very, very well off of each other. And that's a little extra layer to his pathology that kind of turns the movie into more of a character study than it already was.
No, I really appreciate you saying that. Like, I do think there's something when I was watching Joe and David act in that scene where they drive up Mulholland Drive at night, you know, to the dance club or whatever, the strip club, actually.
Yeah.
The empty strip club.
I knew
that I felt that, wow, this is actually a really unique scene between father and son, because like, whatever, I've had these scenes where you just drive along with your dad and there's this like awkward tension and you guys are trying to connect, but like you really can't. And like, you know, an audience is like kind of stuck observing that and kind of like laughing until things maybe take a crazier turn. So yeah, I mean, David is really fun guy and super good improver, like Joe and like Sashir. And so, you know, they were just able to discover things. And before the movie even started, Joe and David had never met and they were supposed to be father and son, right? So I said, why don't we all go out on a night on the town in character and film it? And so about two weeks before principal photography began, we did that. And it was so inspiring just to see them act as this father, son, you know, like just kind of, you know, David's character, Chris Gunkel, right, is this washed up 90s DJ. And he is, you know, just as desperate for attention as Kurt and just as childish about it, maybe more childish about it. And going out, like we went to a Thai food restaurant, we went to, you know, randomly David Arquette got a text from someone that he made a music video from in the 90s. They made a music video together. And I said, David, like, could you text them back and see if they want to like show it to us? And he's like, yeah, they probably won't have a VCR. And I'm like, could you just text them? And so he did it. And the person was like, yeah, come over. So we went over this random person in the Valley's house that David hadn't seen in like years to watch this music video, in actuality made by David Arquette, but ostensibly made by Chris Kunkel, the character, and his son, Kurt Kunkel, watching it and being like, who are these people? Like, is this what was cool in the 90s? And all this shit. And then like last week on the at Kurt's World 96 Instagram, we presented that whole thing as a live stream to the audience.
Wow.
It was like a 25-minute movie over the course of an hour and a half, where we kept going in and out of liveness. And people really thought it was happening. And, you know, it's really cool to just have two actors vibe with each other like that. And I think, you know, it feels like a really lived in, you know, bad father-son relationship, as opposed to two actors just reading lines, I think.
Absolutely. You're getting a lot of mileage out of this marketing stuff. I tell you what,
yeah,
between the Instagram and all the different avenues that you can go with this. I mean, this can go on in perpetuity, really.
Well, I hope it ends on Friday, really, because it's like I love these interviews and stuff, but doing that account and stuff is really exhausting because I want it to be real. I treat it like a second movie. So I want it to feel really authentic and really narrative based, you know?
And this whole thing was shot on GoPros and iPhones and stuff like that, right?
Yep. Very challenging, but, you know, I think it contributes to the authenticity factor and the kind of horror of it is that it feels real, right?
You have more like coverage and footage to sort through in that instance, right? Because unless you're just specifically just using one camera the whole time, but I didn't know if you were using like five at once or what.
Well, we had certain scenes where we went past the alphabet, right? So that's how you designate cameras.
Damn.
ABCD. Wow. So we had double A's, we had AB AD or whatever. So we like in the taco truck scene, right, where you have all the cameras inside the car, you have him in the taco truck line, you have multiple surveillance cameras, then you have the cop car showing up with the cop body cams and stuff. We had over 26 cameras there. So no, it is a lot to edit with, and that's great because we're also creating a language, a visual language that doesn't incorporate the things normal people normally expect from a movie, which is, you know, master shot, tracking shots, crane shots, whatever. You know, these things are not really part of the vocabulary, or if they are, they're tweaked, you know, for our purposes, because it's presented right as a first person live stream. So, you know, it was great to have all those different angles. And at the same time, it's like, how you have to keep it flowing and comprehensible like a conventional film. So I'm really glad we did it like that, and it, you know, presented its own kind of obstacles and own kind of opportunities to get creative.
Well, yeah. this movie is really cool, and I hope everybody goes out and watches it in theaters. It's actually going to be in drive-ins and stuff like that, but it's also going to be on demand and digital and all that on the 14th. So,
yeah, if you have a drive-in nearby, take the trip, get out of your house, bring the kids, bring the spouse,
bring the kids. Sure, like six and under. This is perfect for them.
any child over five will understand this, like,
yeah, actually,
better,
yeah,
better than their parents, honestly.
Yeah, that's true.
So
that's true.
You know, bring everyone, bring your friends, or just go watch it alone. And and if you don't have a driver nearby, you know, it's on iTunes, Amazon, video, cable on demand, and all that stuff.
No, this is a perfect drive-in movie. This would be fantastic to watch with a bunch of people.
Yeah, definitely. It was funny, just as an aside, I saw that interview you had with Kevin Smith at Sundance, and there was a point where you said you watched Clerks at 12, and I was like, oh, really?
Well, yeah, I mean, like, you know, what I think I said there also is that, like, it was really empowering to see, like, Dogma after Clerks.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Like, yeah, Clerks is the sort of movie you watch, like, oh, I can make a movie with my friends, and it could be, like, stupid and, like, maybe still good. And then you watch Dogma, and you're like, whoa, it's still, like, a movie he made with his friends, and it's still kind of stupid, but he's, like, talking about all sorts of different things that feel, like, important to him and thematic, and, like, you don't really see people talk about religion or, you know, corporatism in this way in comedies ever. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, even though it's a really different type of movie, Spree is kind of in that lineage of, like, well, it could be, like, really energetic and really, like, immediate and realistic feeling, but also, like, you know, talk about something, like, big and still be, like, horror or funny or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We'd like to thank Eugene Kotliarenko for coming in and giving us his time on this. Spree is August 14th. We really liked it. Go out and watch it.
Yes.
That's going to do it for this interview. It's Chris Atkinson and Barrett Scherer. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.
Well, there was one of their brass came out and said, I was just going to wait for that to go by.
There's Los Angeles for you.
Sorry. We have crime in progress nearby.
Yeah, so. Exactly.